I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. When selecting food from the farmer's market or grocery store, do you know where it's coming from? How local is local? Blogger Drew Peters helps run her family's farm in Dover, Pennsylvania, and she's trying to spread the word about a concept she calls ground truthing. It means using technology to verify that your local produce is indeed local. She's our guest this hour, along with Patty Lavera of Food and Water Watch. She'll explain labels, such as the difference between natural and organic, cage-free versus free-range. And Jo Robinson joins us. Her best-selling book, Eating on the Wild Side, explains how to get the most nutrition from fresh produce. An informative food hour ahead on Midday, after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with you every Monday through Friday from noon to 2 p.m. Thanks again for making Midday part of your day. Here are some terms you're most likely to run into during your next trip to the grocery store. You've probably already seen these. Free range, cage free, natural, local, certified humane, organic, antibiotic free, and on. You've seen all of those. But do you know exactly what those words mean? Much has been made in the last decade about the importance of knowing what's in the food we eat and where it comes from, but sifting through the food jargon that's out there nowadays can be confusing. So we're going to try to help you with that a little bit today on the show. We're going to do some food label demystifying for you. One of our guests will be Patty Lavera. Patty Lavera is of Food and Water Watch, and she'll help us sort through some of the more common food labels and what they mean. We'll also be talking later on in the show with author Jo Robinson, whose best-selling book, Eating on the Wild Side, explains how the produce we eat has changed so much over the decades, over the centuries, really, that it's lost much of its nutritional value. She gets into why that's happened and what we can do to counteract it to get the most nutrition out of modern food. But to get us started here, I want to welcome onto the show Drew Peters. Drew Peters helps run her family's Sunnyside farm in Dover, Pennsylvania, and she's trying to spread the word about a concept she calls ground truthing, which means using technology to determine where your food comes from or to verify where it comes from. Drew Peters, we welcome you to the show. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Sunnyside Farm, I mentioned Dover, Pennsylvania, really just over the line from Maryland, south central Pennsylvania, right?
Mm-hmm. But halfway between York and Harrisburg is where we're located.
Yeah, okay. And are you in a pasture-based farm?
We do run a pasture-based farm.
What's a pasture-based farm? What does that term mean, since we're going to be talking about terms today?
So for us, what it means is that all of our livestock are out on pasture year-round. It means that the beef that you get from us is grass-fed beef, and for the way that we grow it, exclusively grass-fed. They don't get grain ever.
Hmm.
Our pigs are out on pasture. USDA has a standard that has to be an average of 3 inches of growth on the field, a percentage of the time for the year in order to be referred to as pasture. It cannot just be a mud lot. And so we are within those that definition of USDA. And if you visit the farm, you see the grass sometimes is shoulder height.
Your husband is Homer?
Homer Walden, yes.
Homer Walden, and it's Sunnyside Farm in Dover, PA. And do you grow produce as well as raise livestock?
We do, and we grow vegetables. I grow heirloom varieties, open pollinated varieties. I don't grow any hybrids, and certainly I don't even know how to grow a GMO crop. But we grow in compost without any chemicals. So I don't use synthetic or organic. We are Food Alliance certified, which is...
What does that mean, Food Alliance certified? I saw that there.
It's a third-party certification. They come and they inspect the farm. They look at your records. They they walk around and actually make random visits as well to see what your practices are. And... we wanted it because it looks at all aspects of your farm activities in terms of how you treat your employees, your waste that goes into the water stream, the air pollution, how much erosion, lots of things. It's not just the use of whatever chemicals are allowed.
Do you consider yourself an organic farm?
I consider ourselves beyond organic.
Okay, beyond organic. B-O. So we know what that term means now. Well, let's go to this term that we want to talk about today, ground truthing.
Yes.
It's a really interesting a phrase. What do you mean by ground truthing?
Well, we participate, our farm, we offer a CSA, which is Community Supported Agriculture. The idea behind it basically is that we partner with people, that we are their farmers. And community supported agriculture means that we basically get paid in advance, and our partners take the same risk that we do. 2 years ago, for 6 weeks, it was incredibly hot, almost no rain. We had a bad year in terms of our vegetables. This year, we've had an incredibly productive year. It's been a beautiful, much more mild summer, much easier for the farmer to be out and growing.
So a CSA. So you have this connection with your customers.
So we do.
So they pay you in advance, and then each week you bring them something, right?
Each week they see me, yeah. And I hand them over what we've harvested that week. And I start to hear from my customers, and they say, oh, well, offered, you know, where I work is a CSA from this company that has all this marketing material. And I go and look at that company's website, and there are no farms listed, but they're calling it a CSA. And so I think for people who are interested in supporting a local farmer in that way, sometimes some people who aren't farmers are now using those terms. And I just want to be able to say there's a way that you can verify what's
verify.
Done.
Trust but verify.
Trust but verify.
Ronald Reagan said once upon a time. So let me ask you this. So the customers in your CSA, in your community supported agricultural model, they don't necessarily come to your farm.
Some do.
Some do, mm-hmm. So they know where you live
they
and where you're
live.
Growing things,
yep.
Right? Others don't. They just trust that you've driven in from Dover, PA, Sunnyside Farm, and offered them eggs this week or whatever you have, right?
Right.
Swiss chard, whatever it is.
Right.
Okay. You're saying use technology to verify where your food's coming from, especially if we're all part of this locavore movement.
Yes.
If a farmer says he's local, he's bringing you local tomatoes that he or she grew, you want to verify that. So how do you do it?
So years ago, we were reading in one of the national catalogs about turkeys that were lovingly grown and you should buy them at what was then an inflated price, and even now is an inflated price. And we thought, I wonder what they're doing with those turkeys. So what's the name of the farm?
I mean, how are they loving them?
How are they loving them?
Was it a Pennsylvania farm?
It was not. And it was in California.
Oh, okay.
And so we looked up the name, we looked up the address, and when we went onto Google Earth and switched it over, not to the map, but to the satellite setting, we could see that it was a building, much as any other poultry operation. And so, how are they loving them differently than, mm-hmm. is that different than...
They weren't free range?
They weren't, well, they might have been. Free range has... just a tiny amount to do with being outside. It means they have access to the outdoors, mm-hmm. which doesn't necessarily mean they ever go outside. But free range means they're not enclosed in cages inside the building.
But when you looked at this particular operation in California, it looked industrial to you?
Absolutely.
Like any other turkey operation you'd seen, all indoors.
So, yes. So we said, well, we should better to just get it from our local industrial turkey producer or grow them a little bit differently, which is what we've opted to do.
In the case that you mentioned earlier about some customers saying that they had been offered a CSA at work or something, they had seen a
yep.
brochure,
yep.
but you saw that there were no farms listed, did you do a ground truth on that?
So
well, there, I guess there wasn't a place to do that.
So there, because the people who were speaking to me had access to the representatives from this company, they asked them, who are the farms? Where do you get it from? Oh, we work with local farmers. Oh, we look. Who are they? Where are they?
Did it
what
sound
are
like a,
they?
Like a cooperative, maybe?
So I don't know what it was.
Couldn't tell.
But I just think that in those kinds of situations, if what your objective is to support a local farmer, to understand their growing practices, the best way, the easiest way, is to go on to Google Earth, find the address, and look at what they're doing. And there are easily evidenced methodologies. If they say it's a grass-fed dairy herd, but when you look, there's this building, and around it is all cropland, Where's the fencing for them to be able to go out and graze?
How can
they do that? Where's the pasture? Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to see that because my picture is updated on Google Earth probably annually. I mean, I know it's been in the last year because of different things that are on the farm that weren't there a year ago. And you never know when they're going to update it, but they do on a regular basis. The satellite flies over and takes pictures of everything.
Right. You're not getting a picture in real time. It's about once a year. You think it's about once a year.
I do.
But you think this is worth doing for folks who really want to know, were these grapes really grown? Were these blueberries really harvested on this mountainside in Frederick, Maryland or something?
I do think so, because I think sometimes if you want to support a real local grower, you may be supporting a local bottler, or you may be supporting a local distributor, small distributor. And to have that one-on-one, if that's what you're interested in, you have the ability to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. I think everybody understands that certain times a year at the farmer's market, you may not be getting local produce. There may be some farmers who are there selling, vendors who have to fill in a little bit, right? Because they know their customers want spinach, and maybe their spinach wasn't so hot, or broccoli, and maybe their broccoli wasn't so hot. So there is some of that done, is there not?
I can't say. I can only say what I do, and I don't do that. I only have what we grow.
But I understand that, what you do. I'm just saying, as a practice elsewhere, you can't always have everything that people want either if you're going to the farmer's market. Why do you think this is important? Do you think there's some deception out there? I mean, you cited the turkey example, but, I mean, is this something you think that is widespread or what? With the locavore movement, it's such a popular idea.
I think, I'm in York County, and I've had people contact me there and say, again, somebody wants to come in and present to our people that they'll do a direct delivery of a CSA. And when you look at that company's website, they're a wholesaler in Jessup.
I see.
And so if they call it a CSA, it starts to impact us as growers, because that's a model that as a small batch grower, we need to depend on for our livelihoods. And in general, I would say we're not bringing it in from across the country or around the world. You can go to the grocery store for that. And if what you want is something different, and if you want to support someone who has different growing practices, that's what we want. That's what I want you to be able to do, particularly, I think, when it comes to vegetables, but also when it comes to livestock.
Well, in particular, livestock. This is very interesting because, as I said, the locavore movement, the growth of farmers markets, there's a lot going on there. People are very interested in this, and there's more and more produce sold in farmers markets than ever. I think Maryland now, I forget what the last count was, 65 farmers markets in this state. I don't know about Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of interest in it. You're saying trust but verify.
I think I've probably said that about everything in my life,
not
just farming.
Especially about food is ground truthing. Well, I'm curious to try that actually with somebody I have in mind that I get eggs from. And, maybe you just want to check to see, are those chickens really roaming around outside? Could I see that in a Google Earth shot?
I could actually see
little chickens roaming around.
Well, you can see something. You can see that there's, that there's grass available to them. And if you Google Earth my farm, you'll see these structures and behind it, bare grass, and ahead of it green grass, and it'll give you a good idea of what direction the pens are going, and I can look at it and say, well, those are turkey pens, that's why it looks so beat up behind them, because turkeys are huge eaters. They
scratch fantastic. Through the ground, right?
Oh, they scratch it bare.
Yeah.
And then that fertilizer they lay down in one day, when you move the pen, 2 weeks' time, you get the greenest flush of growth behind that.
So that's how you
all that
tell.
Nitrogen.
Would that be somewhat true for chickens as well?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Drew Peters is with us. She's going to stay with us for the hour. She's visiting us here at WYPR today from her Sunnyside farm in Dover, Pennsylvania. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, more on the demystifying food with blogger and farmer Drew Peters, but also Patty Lavera is going to be joining us from Food and Water Watch, and we'll get to ask her about some of these labels we see in the supermarket today. You know, in the supermarket, when you see local, the little local sticker on a zucchini or something, what exactly does that mean in a Baltimore supermarket? Organic, what does that mean? Cage-free, free-range, what does it all mean? 410-662-8780 is the phone number for Midday if you'd like to join us, if you have a question. Also, our email address is midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday, and I encourage you to call if you have a question about food labeling, 410-662-8780, or if you want to ask Drew Peters a question about using technology to verify where your food's coming from, especially if you're interested in supporting the local food movement and you go to farmers markets and you want to make sure those radishes came from a farm where they say it came from. Give us a call if you have a question about how that works, 410-662-8780. Drew Peters remaining with us today, who with her husband runs Sunnyside Farm in Dover, Pennsylvania, and Drew also blogs, and we put a link on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page to Drew's blog. And now, Drew, we welcome Patty Lavera to the show. Patty Lavera is Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch, the D.C.-based policy group that we've had exposed on the show to our listeners before. Patty, it's nice for you to join us again today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, we're taking a look at words and what they mean when it comes to food. You know, this is a constant thing, and it's good maybe today to provide a bit of a refresher for people who think they already know the answers to these questions. And some of us who go to the supermarket or the farmer's market or any market and wonder, what exactly does that mean? So I want to start you with this one, Patty. The word local is big right now in the summertime, right? Because mm-hmm. there's supposedly a lot of local produce coming into the big supermarkets. And I don't just mean the farmer's markets now. So, you know, if you go to a Giant or a Safeway or somewhere in Maryland, Baltimore, and you see that local sticker on a zucchini or a tomato, do we know what it means?
Well, it means what Giant or Walmart or Safeway says that it means. So we don't have that's not a word that's regulated.
It's not a standard
word.
So
you have to do some homework, unfortunately, and it's going to shift from place to place. So, for example, Walmart got a bunch of press a couple of years ago and said, we're going to buy more local food. Their definition of local is that it's from that state. Well, if you're in Rhode Island, that's pretty impressive. If you're in California, maybe not, because they were already growing a lot of produce in California or Florida or Texas, and they averaged their local buying out over the whole country, and they could actually hit their goal by buying some produce in Florida and Texas and California. So you really, sadly, as a consumer, have to do a lot of homework.
Well, I don't know if it's sadly. It means a little bit of work, right? Or be helpful maybe if some of the supermarkets who use that word in their advertising, their on-site advertising, actually put up a sign explaining what it means. Or maybe they don't want to explain, Drew. Maybe they don't want to explain.
And sometimes they identify it. There's a small chain in southeastern Pennsylvania, Sobel's, and they buy from Miller's Plant Farm. And Dave Miller runs a CSA, but he also supplies to them. And there's pictures of him there.
Oh, I see.
You know, they identify who their local produce comes from.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
So, Patty, let me go to the big one, the word organic. Let's dissect that a bit again. Gee whiz, you go to the supermarket, you see chicken that's organic chicken, supposedly, organic onions, organic everything, really, carrots. So what do we say about that? What does that mean to the American consumer today?
So organic, there's a lot of brands. There's a lot of marketing claims that are made in the grocery store. I mean, there's just dozens. It turns me into a crazy person when I go grocery shopping. Organic stands alone a little bit because of the way that it's set up. So the word organic is actually regulated by the federal government. The USDA writes standards about what organic production is. And there's a set of rules, and then they have set up a system where there are third parties. There's about 100 of them who are called certifiers. And they go out and they have to inspect once a year, and a farmer has to apply to them and say, this is my organic plan. This is how I'm going to raise this food. So we have a lot of confidence that what's happening in the organic label, you're getting what you think you're getting. But the concern is that I think sometimes consumers over assume what the organic standards are. People put a little too many aspirational hopes that everything they've ever wished for in food is in those organic standards, and in some cases, they're not. So, for example, animal welfare standards, and chickens is a good example. We think those standards could be a lot better. But if you know what the standards are, we think that you can have confidence that they're being met because of that label.
Okay, thanks very much. In the case of Sunnyside Farm, Drew Peters' place, the Food Alliance is your certifier.
It's my third-party certifier,
so that
yes.
You get to say organic or beyond organic.
I say beyond organic. I do not say that I'm certified organic. I'm not. I'm Food Alliance certified.
Okay.
So,
well, someone would have to know what that means.
Exactly.
Right?
And the people who I deal with, generally, I'm talking to them across the table at a farmer's market.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interacting with them in person, typically.
We're
a small enough operation that's what we do. And certified organic, there's also a council of growers that participate in the standards that the USDA sets. So there's a council of people around the country who help USDA develop what those standards are of farmers.
Patty, we also see the word natural a lot. Boy, a lot. almost everything from very processed food to fresh food, meats, produce, fruit, vegetables. Does Food and Water Watch have a position on an alert to consumers about the word natural, if it has any meaning to us anymore?
Yeah, and that's pretty much the alert, is that it doesn't. If it's too good to be true, if you can't make it at home and it sits on a shelf and never gets old and is super preserved, or, you know what I mean, you need to use your head and you need to look at the ingredient list. And a lot of things that have that word natural on them is not meeting a normal person's expectation of what natural is. So there's been a lot of call over the years that there should be more regulation of this word. Right now there's very, very little. There's a couple of tiny things that the FDA says you can't do and label it natural, and similarly for USDA and meat and poultry, but you could have a factory farmed raised animal eating, you know, genetically modified feed, and that meat from that animal can be labeled natural. You can have very, very highly processed foods with, lots of preservatives and things like that can be labeled natural. So we think it's really a misleading term in the grocery store.
Yeah, it's become, in my mind, almost meaningless when I see that now. But back on organic, I meant to ask this question. Does organic mean chemical-free necessarily?
There's ground rules for what the organic standards are. So you're not using, for animals, you're not using antibiotics. You're not feeding genetically engineered feed. You're not giving artificial hormones. And then for crops, you're not using GMOs. You're not using synthetic pesticides or fertilizers. But there are a list of substances, and that's what Drew referenced. There's a board that meets that advises USDA on what the standard should be. They do consider certain materials to say, you know, this is synthetic, but we're going to let it in. And there's a process for considering those materials. And to organic's credit, they air that process out in the public. I go to those meetings twice a year where they have those conversations about materials. We get the public involved, lots of other groups do, to say that should be allowed or that shouldn't be allowed. So it's not that there's zero chemicals, but there's a process for figuring out what those chemicals are, and they're not, as a rule, they're not synthetic chemicals that are being used.
Okay, Patty. Thank you. Patty Lavera from Food and Water Watch. I invited our listeners to call in with questions, so we're going to take a couple right now. Drew Peters, you can answer, or Patty, if you want to add to this, feel free, okay? We'll start with John. John has a question for us. Go right ahead, John. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I'm wondering about, from the producer's side, how can the producers of local produce and animals connect with the consumers, retailers, restaurants, and others who might be interested in their products?
Well, first off, I would recommend registering on localharvest.com. If you register as a grower there, there's spots for you to list all the different things that you have available and to update it very easily, very quickly. And when people do a search for, you know, local bacon,
mm-hmm.
or whatever it is they're looking for,
yeah.
Many times local harvest is one of the first things that
I've
appears.
Seen that website.
Yeah.
It's a rich website.
Yep.
So, and restaurateurs use it.
Not so much restaurateurs. I
thought they used it for reference to find
they
food.
May.
Yeah. I had a couple on the show said that they
did.
Yeah.
Great.
So are you on there? You're listed on there?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I have people who visit the farm who purchase from us on a regular basis that find us through there. Hmm. And they'll process the payments so that as a grower, you can focus on growing as opposed to gathering money and taking care of that business side. They'll help us with that.
That's the best, quickest way to get your name out there and what you produce.
Well, I certainly think that's the first one you always want to be listed on there. To be engaged with a farmer's market of any kind is a good way, because at a farmer's market, you'll meet other growers who grow other things than what you do, and word starts to spread. To meet the chefs is really just a matter of going and knocking on the back door and saying, I'm a farmer, I have these things. And what happens eventually is that you're in that restaurant, that chef's network. And by December, January, we're sitting down with the chefs who are saying, I'm going to need this from you over the summer. I'm going to need that from you. You get somebody like, you know, Spike at Woodbury Kitchen. I mean, it's not a mystery how many tons of tomatoes he needs and how many they can and how many they use through the year. But they do that with everything. They get, you name it, they get it. Peppers and beans and beets, and they preserve tonnage of stuff so mm-hmm. that they're using local year round. But they're not the only ones. There are a number of other restaurants that do the same thing.
Very good. Thank you very much, Drew Peters from Sunnyside Farm. I want to take another call. This is Joe with a question about livestock, growing animals for food. Hi, Joe. Joe, are you there?
You're talking to me? No, I'm Jim.
All right, is it Jim? I'm sorry, Jim.
Sorry. Thanks, Dan. Yeah, I specifically, if the poultry is not contained, and if the pork is not kept, I have visited pork facilities that you had to dress in coveralls and total gear and boots and everything that was sterilized to enter the building where the bacon was grown, and chickens not so much, but still chickens that are subject to the birds that are flying over and dropping diseases on them. How does Drew control diseases that might come to that farm?
Hmm. Well, first off, we're fully fenced. Our property is, and then the smaller livestock, the poultry and the pigs, until they get to a certain size, they're in enclosed cages that are on wheels that we move every day. And if you visit the blog or the website, you can see pictures of what they look like.
So how do you avoid, the contamination that Jim is raising?
It's covered. It has to be, not just because of contamination, but everybody loves chicken.
You mean they're protected?
They're protected. They have to be because hawks, owls,
yeah,
snakes,
fox, right.
Possum, weasels, mink. I mean, it's the quantity that of things that love chicken, your neighbor's dog, your neighbor's cat. I mean, everybody mm-hmm. loves a nice fresh, especially a nice young tender chicken.
Let me ask you this. When people inquire about buying eggs from you mm-hmm. or poultry or chicken, mm-hmm. What do you say about how they're grown? Do you use a term such as cage-free, free-range? Because I'm going to ask Patty in a minute what those terms mean. What do you say, Drew?
So I say ours are pasture-raised, and they're in movable pens that we move daily.
Pasture-raised in movable pens mm-hmm. that we move daily. Okay, that sounds pretty good. You got a dozen on you. Patty, let me go to you on that, because that's another thing we see more and more of in the supermarket are, you know, dozens of eggs offered for sale advertised as cage-free or organic or free-range.
Yeah, I think the egg case is where I send people if I want to give them a little seminar on marketing claims on food. I mean, they're running mm-hmm. out of room on egg packages to make
claims. They are.
Right?
They are. It's
There's
true.
No more real estate there. And so you have. This is where we advise people, you know, to think of your most literal-minded friend, you know, your uncle, your neighbor who takes everything and picks it apart. You need to be that guy when you're shopping for eggs. And so cage-free means only that, nothing more. It just means there's not cages. It doesn't mean those birds are outside, like on Drew's farm. It doesn't mean that they had a lot of space. It just means there weren't cages. There are still plenty of eggs that are grown in cages, so that is a distinction. But consumers shouldn't be optimistic and over attribute positive attributes that aren't there. You know, free range is means a bunch of different things to in the way that it's used. You're better off. I think eggs are one of the best things that you can buy local because you can ask more questions about where they're coming from, and you can especially at a CSA or a farmer's market, you can ask, you know, are you outside? Are they on pasture? And if you're not getting answers to that, that probably isn't what's happening. They're probably in a building, and some of them can get out, but maybe they're only getting out to like a dirt, to a dirt area. They're not actually on fresh grass, which is what sounds like when you're rotating them, like on Drew's farm. Organic tells you a lot about what they're eating. They're eating organic food. It's not GMO. It wasn't grown with synthetic pesticides or fertilizers, and they're not getting antibiotics or growth promoters like that. At this point, this is an area where we think the organic standards could get a lot better. It's not telling you that all those birds are outside very often. So that's one place we think the organic standards could get better. But you do know what they're eating and that they're not getting drugs and growth promotants.
Well, the state of Maryland has changed what can be fed to poultry. They have disallowed arsenic in a small dosage in daily feed, and laws were passed that they can no longer do that. But in organic operations, there is a organic equivalent of that that is still able to be fed organically. And it's fed to them because it has the effect of a growth hormone. It is not a growth hormone, but it causes the birds to grow larger faster.
Yes, that's one of those examples of those exceptions. So I think you're probably talking about methionine. So it's a synthetic amino acid that they give them, and there's been big fights at these meetings about what are the standards. And a lot of folks are saying if we changed the environment they're in, if there weren't so many of them inside, they wouldn't need this synthetic amino acid to help them grow. So that's a perfect example of how the organic standards are always up for debate, and we're trying to get them to be to really prop up and really raise up the standards and meet consumers' expectations.
Speaking of GMO, genetic modified, let's go to, is it Dawn? I'm sorry. Yes, Dawn has a question in this regard. Welcome to Midday, Dawn.
Hi, Dan. Setting aside pesticides and hormones and focusing solely on the term GMO, how does genetically modified, say, for instance, corn, differ from organic corn, except that it may be resistant to certain diseases?
Patty, you want to go to this from Food and Water Watch, and we'll hear from Drew too. But Patty?
Sure. So the genetically engineered or the GMO corn is going to be a different seed, and so the organic seed will not have undergone that change. The genetically engineered seed has been engineered to do something, and there's a couple different traits that are most commonly engineered into that crop. It's either incorporating pesticides into the tissue of the plant, so something called BT, so that's now, instead of being a topical pesticide that you would use, it's now incorporated into the tissues of the plant. The other major trait is that the crop would be herbicide tolerant, which means you can spray the field with an herbicide like Roundup, and the corn or the soy that's been engineered is supposed to survive and the weeds are supposed to die. Organic seeds would not be tolerant of herbicides like Roundup because they haven't been engineered to survive it, and they're not allowed to use Roundup anyway. So you have different seeds that you're starting with, and then the management techniques are going to be different because organic isn't allowed to use Roundup, isn't allowed to use that kind of synthetic herbicide. And even if they did, and this happens actually, if their neighbors accidentally spray their crop, it will die because it hasn't been engineered to tolerate exposure to that herbicide. When conventional GMO crops, they're going to be sprayed with that, and they're going to survive, and then they're going to keep growing, and hopefully the weeds are dying, although now the weeds are getting resistant to the Roundup.
Drew?
On my farm, we are GMO-free feed for our poultry, and my reason for that is a genetically modified corn or soy. When they spray what they put onto that field, the only thing that survives is that corn or that soy. It doesn't just kill the weeds, it kills everything, every bug, every worm, every bird, every bee, every. And so I see it as a little bit more extreme because of the damage that it does to everything on the field.
Drew Peters from Sunnyside Farm in Dover, Pennsylvania, going to stay with us for the remainder of the hour. We have to say goodbye now to Patty Lavera, but actually Thank you very much for this helpful information. It was a good refresher for me and very helpful. Thank you, Patty.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yep, Patty Levera from Food and Water Watch. When we get back after this short break, Joe Robinson will be joining us. Her book, Eating on the Wild Side, explores how our modern produce has devolved nutritionally over the years and what we can do to counteract that. So this is Midday. Please stay tuned. Email from Kevin, one of our listeners here on the Midday Show. It says, buying local produce is important because there is less environmental impact, less gasoline, bringing goods to market. That's important to me. Organic or a no pesticide sticker is more important for me. I used to hear the term in transition, which means it takes 3 years of not using pesticides before a farmer could claim their produce was organic. Does that sound familiar, Drew?
Absolutely true.
Yeah, Drew Peters from Sunnyside Farm visiting us today from Dover, Pennsylvania. And now we get to say hello to Joe Robinson. Joe Robinson's best-selling book, Eating on the Wild Side, The Missing Link to Optimum Health, is now out in paperback. It talks about how produce has devolved nutritionally over the years, and many years, actually centuries of cultivating the things that we eat from their wild natural beginnings. So, Joe Robinson, it's nice to have you on the show today. Thank you for joining us.
Well, you're welcome.
But I must ask you, you know, this is a hard one because, like, what do we do about it? Corn, for instance. Corn is in season now. Corn is so delicious, the fresh corn. Bread and, what is it, butter and, what is it?
Silver Queen.
Silver Queen and bread and butter corn. And it's so good. And I read in your book that, you know, the corn that we eat today has a lot more sugar content than the original grass plant that it evolved from years ago from Mexico. So higher sugar content, you know, eating corn this week can have the same impact on your blood sugar as eating a Snickers candy bar. That's so depressing, Joe. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to start with that one because almost everybody loves corn in the summertime.
Well, we love sugar. We're programmed to like sweet things. It's one of the most important drives we have, because when we were out there eating wild food, we had to be rewarded for getting things that were high in calorie. There wasn't a lot of sweet. There wasn't a lot of fat. So our brains then and now tell us that's what we like to eat. Corn's a great example. Like field corn, which we feed to animals, is about 2% sugar. Old-fashioned sweet corn, which people used to love, has 6% sugar, and the ones we eat now, the white super sweets, are 40% sugar. And also, what people don't know is that super sweet corn is because of genetic mutations. Some of them were man-devised, these mutations. They bombarded things with all kinds of X-rays and, you know, different sort of cobalt radiation. And then they grew these plants out, and they selected ones that were the sweetest and, the less starch and more sugar. But even more important than that is that we have taken away the phytonutrients in corn. Phytonutrients are compounds that plants produce to protect themselves from insects and from UV light, from animal predation, insect predation. And corn has a fraction of the phytonutrients of the the original corn, and even the sweet corn that we don't even eat sweet corn anymore. And the white has gotten rid of all of the beta carotene. So it's a perfect example of what we've done over the millennia. It's just to select something that is sweeter or bigger or softer or fewer seeds, thinner skin, to suit our taste buds, not knowing what we were doing.
Not knowing what we were doing. So when you look at the history, Joe, at the farming practices of our ancestors all through time here, up over the centuries, cultivating wild plants, they went for what was most pleasurable, what was going to end up being, the sweetest, the starchiest, the fattest, the fattiest?
And also the most productive.
Mm-hmm.
Growing the fastest. We want things to grow really fast. Well, it turns out that these phytonutrients in plants accumulate over time. So something that is, like an early peach, is, you know, has been bred to mature much, much faster. And so it accumulates fewer phytonutrients. And we have made these changes consistently for 12,000 years, which is as long as we've been farmers.
Well, in the case of corn, I need to ask, what do we do about that? How do you get around? It doesn't sound like you can get around the sugar.
You can. I'm growing a corn called Ruby Queen, which is red. Remember, corn used to be multicolored, red, blue, purple, black. And we just selected the yellow and then pale yellow and now white. And sometimes with pale yellow mixed in with it. So this red corn that I grow, which you can get the seeds for, is going to be rich in phytonutrients, and it's not as high in sugar. But it's difficult with corn because almost everything you see in the supermarket now is like 98% of it is super sweet. But, you know, it's not going to kill you to have corn at your picnic.
I get the point. The point is that this is not the corn. This is not your great-great-grandfather's corn.
No, and that's true for most of our fruits and vegetables. They're dramatically lower in phytonutrients and higher in starch and sugar.
True.
And on our farm, we try and grow vegetables. Well, we do grow vegetables chemical-free, which sometimes means we have crop failures because the bugs eat them. But we've discovered that the variety Country Gentleman has a tighter twist at the top of the husk, which means the corn earworm can't get in there through those silks. And it's a smaller ear of corn. It's nowhere near as sweet, she's right, but it's delicious corn. It also, it's an older variety. It does not hold its sweet very long. We have to pull it and get it right to people and say to them, corn's coming, you know, and hopefully it's growing now and hopefully we'll have a harvest, but it will not keep sweet. The sugars don't hold as long as the modern varieties of corn.
Right.
Are you familiar with the Ruby Queen that Joe just mentioned?
Yes.
So, since you have community-supported agriculture, CSA, if your customers were to say, hey, give us the most nutrient-rich corn you could produce, maybe you would give it a try?
I would. We are always trying
new
varieties of old varieties.
Right. I was pleased to read about purslane, changing the subject here from corn to purslane, Joe. I just had to ask you about this because this is kind of a running joke in my family. Purslane is this what a lot of people will see as a weed. You know, they don't think of it as something you can actually eat. It grows along the edge of the driveway or on the, you see it on the sidewalk. You see it all over the place. And Drew told me before the show that she pulls it out of the ground, gives it to her pigs to eat, right? But it's this crispy green. I don't know how you would describe it. It kind of reminds me of watercress in some ways. But my mother used to pick this in the backyard and put it in salad. So I see it, I grab it, I put it in a pot. That's the only thing I'm actually successfully growing this year is purslane.
My co-author of a previous book, Dr. Simopoulos, was the first person to discover that purslane is very rich in omega-3 fatty acids and glutathione. These are things that we now know to be really important for health. But we didn't know that until I think she did this study in maybe 1985, something like that. not only purslane, but most wild plants, wild greens, are higher in phytonutrients and omega-3 fatty acids. So those are some of the things we lost when we took those wild plants and just started shaping and cultivating them and, you know, mutating them in some cases over time. We left behind a lot of the things our bodies expect to be fed and that are important for our health.
You know, you can tell with some plants. I mean, tomatoes that you get out of the supermarket in March, just, you know, they just look so unappealing. But what about the tomatoes that we see in the farmer's market in July and August that look so rich and fat and juicy? What about those? Have we lost something even with those?
Well, we have. And again, like most wild tomatoes are small. I grow a variety of wild tomato called Matt's Wild Cherry Tomatoes. They're about half of an inch in diameter. And those smaller tomatoes have 20 times more of a phytonutrient called lycopene, which is linked with a lower risk of heart attack and stroke. But what we've done over the millennia is choose and develop larger and larger tomatoes. Now, the ones that are grown in a farmer's market are ripen on the vine, and they have all of that wonderful lycopene that that variety can have. So they're a big improvement. We need to know that cherry tomatoes in the store actually are better for us than the large beefsteak ones, even if they're heirloom. So going back to that original genotype of small tomatoes gives us more of this heart-healthy phytonutrient.
You know, Drew mentioned that the corn she grows, you know, it loses its sweetness rather quickly.
Mm-hmm.
What about nutrient value and the timing of everything? Some of the things we see in the supermarket, Joe, have been, you know, were harvested in California, down in Texas, Florida, get to us maybe a week later, 4 or 5 days later. Who knows how long later. I assume we're losing something in that process, too.
Yes, and this is a big positive thing about our new local small farms and our farmers markets, because some of the most nutritious vegetables that we can eat, they lose their phytonutrients by the hour. So, for example, asparagus, in the second day, it has lost 20% of its phytonutrients, and by the end of a week, it's lost 60%. And unless you buy your asparagus at a farmer's market or grow it yourself, it's going to be a week old or more. I've seen stuff in the supermarket that's desiccated. It's so old. So some other things are important to get at a farmer's market because they lose phytonutrients so quickly. Spinach, broccoli, artichokes, and kale. So we didn't know this until maybe the last 10, 15 years in our ability to detect these phytonutrients and our understanding of what they do for our health. So this is a brand new wake-up call. We need to have some things as fresh as they can be.
So eating on the wild side, the upshot of your book, there's a lot of information in it, but the advice you're giving in terms of the upshot of the book is for each vegetable, each fruit is divided between vegetables and fruit. The book is, here's what you can do to get the most out of each one. That's what you're presenting here.
That's right. Both in the supermarket and a farmer's market, and I have a lot of recommendations for people to grow, varieties to grow, that have retained some of those old-fashioned healing compounds that we've lost.
A simmering tomato sauce for hours does more than blend flavors. It can triple its, what is it?
Lycopene
content?
So,
yeah, my mother was onto something with that tomato sauce that she cooked for 3 days.
Yes.
All right, okay. Good.
Absolutely. It changes lycopene into a different shape. It's just a molecule that we digest more readily. So it's, I hate to say this, but canned tomatoes and tomato paste are a better source of lycopene than fresh ones because of the heat of the canning. I know people throw bricks at me when I mention that, but science says that's true. It really helps.
You also say that about canned blueberries.
Oh, yes. I don't recommend it, but berries are another fruit or vegetable that increases its potential health benefits if you heat it. So, you know, berry pies are a really great thing.
I'll agree with that. Joe, good note to end it on. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Joe Robinson, her book is published by Little Brown. It's called Eating on the Wild Side, The Missing Link to Optimum Health. We have an extra copy. I'm going to give it to Drew Peters and thank her for being with us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Drew, for coming down from Dover, Pennsylvania, Sunnyside Farm. It was nice to talk to you and hear about your operation there and get your information, your suggestion about ground truthing. That sounds like fun, actually. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks. My pleasure.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our first day of Midday. Please stay tuned for the second hour coming up with David Zerowick, my colleague from the Baltimore Sun. We're going to take a break for a lunch. Wednesday's lunch provided by Apples and Oranges Fresh Market, located at 1900 North Broadway, open daily. For more information, applesandorangesmarket.com.